Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, alumni enrichment, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by M3 Group, a full-service branding agency, as well as publisher of Greater Lansing Business Monthly and Capital Area Women's Lifestyle Magazine. Information on services and publications at m3group.biz.
Back inside Studio S at WKAR East Lansing. Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. I'm back after a week in Montana and the Canadian Rockies, where I ran into a Current State listener. You just never know when or where that's going to happen. Nancy in Milford, it was nice to meet you. We're all back at it, though, here now. Coming up on Current State, the state of oral health in Michigan. We also talk about Detroit Rock City, Detroit's legacy as a rock and roll town. We all know about Motown, world famous, of course. But we had the MC5, and we had Mitch Ryder and Ted Nugent and the White Stripes. Detroit Rock City is the name of a new book by one of our upcoming guests later this hour. At the top of the show today, a Canadian company is proposing drilling as many as 500 new natural gas wells in Michigan using hydraulic fracturing, or fracking. Many see fracking as a means of asserting energy independence in the United States, while others are concerned about environmental impacts and water use. And here to talk with us more about hydraulic fracturing and the natural gas industry here in Michigan, James Clift, who is the policy director at the Michigan Environmental Council. Nice to see you, James.
Good morning.
Briefly revisit the fracking process for us. Explain how it works and especially how water is used in that, please.
Sure. You know, we've been fracking for decades in Michigan. And the idea is once you've drilled a well, if you pump some water and chemicals down there under very high pressure, you can kind of fracture the formation, which allows more of the natural gas or oil to come to the surface. So recently, that's been combined with these horizontal drilling techniques where they drill down maybe 5,000 feet or more, turn horizontally, and then they can go up to a mile or two through a formation. Again, then they use this fracking technique because many of these formations are tighter rock than they used to drill into. It used to be they'd drill into liquid oil. Now they're drilling into very hard rock where there's natural gas and hydrocarbons inside there.
Shale formations.
Mm-hmm. And the Antrim Shale in Michigan is one of the first shale formations that was kind of explored in the country, actually. But that was a very shallow formation. So what we're seeing now is maybe a little deeper formations, a little tighter formations. And they use the fracking to kind of loosen up those hydrocarbons and hopefully bring them to the surface.
And there has been a huge cumulative and economic impact to this. Anybody who's watched the energy sector and natural gas has seen this take off in large measure, I'm under the impression, in large measure because of hydraulic fracturing. We're able to access natural gas that was just inaccessible before.
That's correct.
Okay. And explain the process of water in this, though, because that is central to our discussion.
Yeah, that's key. So when we were fracking the Antrim wells, small vertical wells, we might use 50 to 80,000 gallons of water per well. Not very much water. So when Michigan started regulating water use back in 2008, we actually gave them an exemption because we were really only looking at people who were using more than 100,000 gallons a day, and oil and gas didn't really show up on the radar screen. But since then, these longer horizontal well techniques have come in, and instead of using 50 to 80,000 gallons, now we're seeing 5 to 21 million gallons of water used on each well. So it's kind of exploded their use of water. So every time they're drilling one of these wells, they're also asking the question, where am I going to get water to do my fracking operation?
And where is the water coming from now?
The same place we get our water. Usually our groundwater aquifers is the best place for them to get the water that they're seeking. So they're going to be looking around to see, is that much water available locally?
Are environments being compromised now because of the water use involved in hydraulic fracturing?
Well, that's what we're trying to watch. Is again, this is a fairly new program in Michigan in regulating our large water users. And we do have an award-winning program up and running where first we use kind of a computer simulation model to figure out, is there enough water in this particular sub-watershed? And they use what's called the water withdrawal assessment tool to try to figure that out. The problem in Michigan...
Who is they? Is that the DEQ, the DNR? Is it the companies?
The DEQ kind of runs the program, but they can actually go on this computer system and you can kind of search yourself to see if water is available. The water withdrawal assessment tool, if you Google that, you'll find this state-of-the-art kind of computer simulation in Michigan that really kind of we use as a screening mechanism. And it usually, you know, a lot of places in Michigan, there's a lot of water. So this tells you, yep, go ahead, drill your well, register your well, you report your use to the state of Michigan. Now, unfortunately, where we're finding this oil and gas in Michigan is the same place we have world-class trout streams. So people come from around the world to fish in upper Michigan, the El Sable, the Pine, the Manistee. So in these areas, we need to watch it because you take too much water out of those rivers, and all of a sudden we're impacting the trout and potentially our tourism base. So we're kind of balancing these two sectors as we're looking for water for fracking in northern Michigan.
We're talking with James Clift of the Michigan Environmental Council about natural gas fracking here in the state. Now, a Canadian company we mentioned earlier, referred to earlier, Encana Corporation, hopes to drill up to 500 new natural gas wells in northern Michigan using billions of gallons of water in that process. They will pay for that water, or who owns or controls that water?
So the water is the public. It's held in the public trust. So to the extent that you own land and you drill your well, you don't pay anybody for the water, and they don't either. So
should that change?
Well, we charge a very small nominal fee to kind of report their water use. So large water users in Michigan are paying around $200 a year or something like that. In other states around the country, especially out west where water is more of a commodity, they'll actually have to purchase water more often and pay a lot more for it. In Michigan, because of its relative abundance, as they say, we don't have a system of charging for the water. We just want to make sure when someone uses it that we're protecting the natural resources and making sure they're not impacting our rivers and streams and the aquatic health of those streams in Michigan.
From what you know about Michigan regulators and agencies, how much faith do you have in their ability to monitor this situation?
Again, this is a new program, so we're kind of using some new science. But I think we're doing, you know, it's better than nothing, which is what we had before 2008. I think we're doing a relatively good job. Now, the key here is looking forward is making sure that, you know, everybody is registering their well and making sure that we're monitoring those flows to make sure that the fish and other aquatic species are safe in these situations. But as I say, up to now, I do have faith in kind of the process that we've set up. And again, as climate change moves in, getting hotter in Michigan summers, you know, more pressure on the water, more pressure for agricultural irrigation. So this is a system that we're learning every year how to do it better, and hopefully, you know, we have our arms around this one.
How deep can these wells go? Do you anticipate the drilling to go even deeper and more horizontal?
You know, I think, you know, at the 2-mile stretch, you're probably hitting the outer limits of where, how far a single well will go.
Wow.
Now we have two questions here. Now, you get the water and getting the water for the well, then a lot of it comes back to the surface. That's where we get really interested in making sure that that contaminated water is properly disposed of. And what happens there is we re-inject it down into one of the brine layers, again, thousands of feet below the surface, where it's isolated from our drinking water. So we've got to kind of watch the where are they getting water from on the quantity side. Then once the water comes back to the surface, make sure we dispose it right because of the quality.
Has that gone smoothly so far?
That's one thing that Michigan has done better than other states around the country. When that water comes back up to the surface, we require that they put it in steel tanks until it is re-injected into the ground. Some other states around the country, they were allowing them to put it in ponds. Those were leaking, contaminating groundwater aquifers and contaminating people's drinking water. So this is one of the places where Michigan's program better than some places around the country.
Now, Democrats in the Michigan House have introduced some fracking safety bills I know you're aware of. How would these bills strengthen fracking regulations?
Again, we exempted oil and gas from this water withdrawal assessment process to begin with. Now, we've administratively kind of bypassed that exemption now, and we're requiring that they go through that process.
That's what the bills would do.
That one of the bills would say, let's get rid of the exemption. Let's just put them officially back into the process so that some future administration couldn't decide to take them back out.
Okay.
So let's fix that. Disclosing the chemicals that are used in that fracking process. Make sure the neighbors know exactly what chemicals are getting mixed with the water before it's injected back in. Just to make sure that if something spills or if there's a blowout in a well, they're going to know what to look for as far as contaminants.
But right now, all of the contaminated water goes back underground?
Goes back underground.
Okay, none of it sits on the surface.
No, and we've had a really good track record in that regard.
An op-ed in yesterday's New York Times by an oil and gas engineer points out how much methane is leaked into the air in natural gas fracking. Can you talk to us about that?
Sure. So when we look at methane and people think natural gas, this must be good from a greenhouse gas standpoint, less carbon than coal, which we rely on to produce a lot of our electricity. So people think as we move toward natural gas, we're going to be doing better on that greenhouse gas climate change front. Scientists are now saying, well, not so fast. Methane, 25 times more potent as carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas. So to the extent that that's leaking out, depending on what that leakage rate is, maybe we're not doing, you know, Mother Nature a favor there as far as carbon goes. And that tells us we need to tighten up the system. Make sure that we're capturing the methane at the wellhead, capturing it along the pipelines, and that we're not letting it leak out. Because that's the key to kind of getting that carbon equation down, reducing our impact.
And methane is the key component of natural gas.
It is.
Correct. You've got the natural gas industry and state regulators saying they've got a handle on this. The state points to what it says is careful and appropriate land use. You've got the industry claiming no undue harm. How well defended is the industry and state regulators in this debate?
I think we need to kind of treat this fuel with more respect. A lot of times you hear around the country about flaring, where people will have natural gas, and maybe that's in an oil well, and you'll see those flames coming out of the top of a pipe by an oil and gas operation. So that's flaring some of that leaking methane or natural gas off. In this country, we flare 25% of what we use as far as natural gas. So a huge amount of natural gas that we just flare off the top of that pipe.
That's enormous.
That's enormous.
I never would have guessed that.
And to me, that's kind of a lack of respect. If you're going to drill for fossil fuels, you should be ready to capture everything that comes to the surface, make sure it doesn't leak, make sure that we're putting all of it to good use.
One way that's been suggested to lower the potential impact of fracking is the use of gray water. Can you tell us what gray water is?
Yeah, so you're looking for fresh water for kind of using, you know, for the fracking operation. Our question is there other water that might be slightly contaminated, sometimes maybe from an old industrial facility? Sometimes we have these aquifers in Michigan that are contaminated and we can't use them for drinking water anymore. There's actually a large one up in the Kalkaska, Mancelona area. So we're asking the question, can they tap into those, you know, slightly contaminated aquifers instead of using the fresh water to try to minimize the impact on the water we all need and kind of the natural resources needs to be healthy.
Does that have a future as far as you're concerned?
We're looking into it. I guess we're, you know, that's just come up in the last couple of months. So we've informed state officials. They're looking at it. We're, you know, trying to get the message out to the industry. They could do themselves a little PR favor via maybe not using kind of the fresh water right out of the aquifer that we're trying to use for drinking purposes.
And anybody who has listened to NPR over the years has heard occasional reports on earthquakes that have been triggered by hydraulic fracturing. I want to say in Ohio and or Pennsylvania. Where has that, where is the dust settled on the earthquake debate?
So where that's come from is when they've re-injected the fluids back into the ground. So Pennsylvania really doesn't have very good formations for re-injecting the flow back water back into the ground. They truck a lot of it right over the edge of Ohio. They were pumping a lot of it down into these wells, probably over-pressurizing them along where there's fault lines. So you think about this fracking fluid, a lot of it is made to be a little slippery to let the hydrocarbons out, and what we had is movement. So we actually triggered some small earthquakes down there. Again, Michigan's geology, we don't have those fault lines, so that has not been a problem in Michigan. We don't expect it to be a problem in Michigan, although, as I say, small ones in this Midwest region have been triggered.
We've been talking about hydraulic fracturing and water use with James Clift. He is the policy director at the Michigan Environmental Council. Thanks, James.
Thank you.
This segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. According to federal statistics, young Americans miss around 51 million hours of school each year due to oral health problems. For about a year now, a philanthropic effort of Delta Dental of Michigan called Brighter Futures has tried to tackle both the health and the educational challenges involved in that situation. In fact, later today, Delta Dental and Brighter Futures will make a major contribution to the Michigan Department of Community Health toward expanding community fluoridation and other programs. And right now we're joined by two guests to talk with us about the state of oral health in Michigan, as well as the Brighter Futures program. Chris Farrell is the Oral Health Program Director for the Michigan Department of Community Health. Hi, Chris.
Good morning.
And Serena Gleason is a spokesperson for Delta Dental of Michigan.
Good
Hi, Serena.
Morning. Hello.
Chris Farrell, before we get to Delta Dental's recommendations here, and their contribution, I'm curious how much interaction is there typically between your agency and health insurers. Is there a lot?
In terms of health insurers, I'm not really a specific health insurers, not that much. But Delta Dental has been a major partner for us for actually over 20 years. Been working with them on a small contract, Developmental Dental Disabilities Treatment Fund. And then we have worked with them on other major partners, Healthy Kids Dental. We've worked on the Panda Project. And then with our own...
What's the Panda Project?
Oh, the Prevent Abuse and Neglect Through Dental Awareness.
Ah,
that's
yes.
been over
okay.
for 20 years. And then with the oral health program itself, we have been very close partners. We work with them on our oral health coalition, a statewide oral health coalition. They're one of our major partners. So the oral health program has been intimately involved with Delta Dental for, like I said, more than 20 years in a variety of topics in a variety of ways.
And Delta is not only making a major contribution here toward fluoridation mm-hmm. programs, but you've gone a little further this time and gone so far as to make some policy recommendations. Serena, what are a few of the key ones?
Sure. Well, one thing I want to mention is tooth decay still tops the list as the number one chronic childhood disease in America today, which is really amazing. And we want to change this. We want to change this. And we think there are some common sense things that can be incorporated within the state to help prevent dental disease and help detect these issues earlier on. So we've identified several areas. One in which has been in the recent news is Healthy Kids Dental. And we would like to see that continued expansion go into all of the counties, the 83 counties here in Michigan.
What's the heart of Healthy Kids Dental?
Essentially, it's a program that gives dental access to Medicaid-eligible children.
Okay.
So it's currently in 75 counties.
78.
Well, 75 and then three more in October, which was just recently passed.
So just about all of them.
Right. Just about. So, you know, the goal is to increase this this program into all of it, the 83 counties.
Well, the governor talks a lot about Healthy Kids Dental and other health folks that you work with,
right.
Chris. Your Delta Dental's making a pretty significant contribution today, $272,000.
Right,
yeah. And tell us more about what that's going toward.
Yeah, well, Chris and I were just talking, and this will be the fourth consecutive year that we've provided grant funding, and this is all done through our foundation, the Delta Dental Foundation.
Okay.
And in particular, this grant funding is going towards community water fluoridation, sealant programs in the schools. And then I believe there's a research component as well involved. But those are the two primary areas. And just to note, water fluoridation and the sealant programs, that's another area that we're going to continue to focus in on from a policy perspective to help increase and continue support for those programs. It's all about increasing access to care and also looking at preventative measures to decrease oral health issues down the road.
Chris Farrell, is access arguably on the short list of challenges regarding health care in Michigan?
Oh, I have oral health is definitely on a short list.
Access to oral health. I mean, actually connecting with a dental professional.
Yes, okay. It is very much so on a short list. I have actually a long list of challenges that I am trying to address. The $272,000 does help address some of that access issues. As Serena mentioned, school-based sealant programs are one of the evidence-based dental programs, prevention programs that are identified by the U.S. Preventive Health Services Task Force. So we are trying to provide access to kids to get some preventive services through a sealant programs. Through school-based sealant programs, and this money will help us to try to expand. We do not have a lot of money towards oral health from the state, so we do rely on a lot of foundations, private grants and federal grants to help us expand oral health services.
51 million hours of school missed due to oral health problems. And granted, there's an awful lot of school kids in this country. That still sounds like an awful lot of
hours. It is
hours.
An awful lot.
Who isn't getting adequate dental care, and why not?
Oh, it runs across the whole continuum. We are really addressing and trying to go towards prevention, especially the 0 to 5-year-old children, trying to make sure that they have preventive dental care so that they don't have the treatment needs or they need to have, you know, major problems, you know, cavities, root canals, anything with, you know, as we go forward with their life. But then you start get into some of the other populations, even adults here in the state, depending on if they're uninsured, if they are disabled, the elderly, all of them. In fact, you can pretty much go across the board, the whole continuum of there are problems with access for everybody for oral health.
There is a noisy, seemingly endless debate over water fluoridation for dental health, and I know the Michigan Dental Association and many professionals support fluoridated water, but that has not stopped some communities, like Heartland Township in Livingston County, right next door to us here, and a number of others from across the country, from dropping it. They claim it's dangerous or corrosive or wasteful. What's the status of the fluoride wars right now in Michigan?
Actually, I would beg to differ that there's an endless debate. In my opinion, that war is over. We won that war 65 years ago when we first implemented water fluoridation in Grand Rapids. So over 200 million Americans right now have voted to approve community water fluoridation in their water system. So the debate, it really is over. The science proves it. We have, it's safe, it's healthy, and it provides community water fluoridation provides 20 to 40% reduction in dental caries or cavities. So,
well, the folks at Heartland Township haven't gotten the message, I guess. I mean, they voted 5-2 to stop it.
I was at that committee meeting.
Oh, you were? Okay.
They have some natural fluoridation already in their wells, and so they there was quite a lot of debate, and yes,
debate as to whether more needed to be added. Was that part of the debate?
That was part of the debate.
Okay. Now, in 2011, I know the federal government did concede that some people may be getting too much fluoride, and like I say, some communities have dropped the amount in their water. How does that figure into this?
I wouldn't say that they were conceded. What has happened over, like I said, 65 years of community water fluoridation, I think it was good government and good public policy that they went back through and looked at whether or not the levels of fluoride that we were getting needed to be remain the same. And so, yes, they have come out with recommendation levels to drop the amount to 0.7 parts per million. But I think you have to remember that our lifestyle has changed, our diet has changed, where we eat has changed, and so we're getting fluoride in a lot of different ways. Could be in our beverages, could be in our foods. So I think it was good public policy to relook at and where's the science at, where fluoride is in the water, and the recommendation. I think it's a valid recommendation. I don't think it's a matter of conceding the point. We just want to make sure that people stay healthy and that it's, you know, that remains safe.
Some pro-fluoridation folks maintain that there's junk science involved in this thing. Are you one of those people?
Yes, I believe that we look at the evidence. There are a number of evidence-based scientific studies, and yes, we do go. One of the major sites that we use is the CDC. We'll look at the EPA. The World Health Organization is one of the organizations that supports it. There are over 35 major health organizations that continue to support it. And yes, the evidence and the science does support community water fluoridation is safe and healthy.
Chris Farrell, as long as you're here, I have to ask, you worked in the Medicaid policy area before you were appointed to this position in oral health, and I know your boss, Jim Haveman, is testifying on Medicaid expansion at the state capitol. Yep. What's your perspective on the current debate in Michigan as to whether to expand funding?
I think it's the right thing to do. I just mentioned about access to oral health, and I'm hoping that with the Medicaid expansion, that dental care will be part of that Medicaid expansion. Adults definitely need oral health care for speaking, for function, for employment. We all have seen people who have not very nice looking teeth and, you know, what kind of jobs that they can get. I really think that access to oral health care and Medicaid expansion is the right thing to do. It could help reduce health care costs. We have seen a lot of adults using the emergency room for, dental pain, which is really not the appropriate use of an emergency room. Mm-hmm. So we're hopefully that Medicaid expansion will help reduce those kinds of health care costs.
We will find out soon enough. Chris Farrell is the Oral Health Program Director for the Michigan Department of Community Health, and Serena Gleason is a spokesperson for Delta Dental of Michigan. Thanks for coming in.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Current State on WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's often said that Michigan is the second most agriculturally diverse state in the country, just behind California. Not surprisingly, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has a strong presence in the Mitten and in the Upper Peninsula, but there's a lesser-known branch of the USDA that has nothing to do with crops or cattle. The agency's Rural Development Office supports the smaller communities that in turn support the nation's farmlands. This month, the office announced it's offering grants to rural public TV stations across the country to convert to digital. Broadband technology is just one of many projects on its list, and here to tell us more about USDA Rural Development is Agency State Director James Turner. Mr. Turner, welcome to Current State.
Good morning, Mark. It's good to be with you.
Michigan is often at the forefront of national debates about farming and agriculture, and Senator Debbie Stabenow, of course, chairs the Senate Ag Committee, but rural development issues don't seem to get as much press. Why not?
Well, because we're rural, and most of the things we finance are in, less populated areas, and it's difficult to get that message out, so that's why I'm glad I had this opportunity today.
And a lot of them don't have to do with crops or livestock or anything like that, too.
That's part of this, right? Yeah, our programs fall into three basic areas. Our largest component is housing. We're the old Farmers Home Administration, in reality.
Okay.
And we'll probably expend somewhere in the neighborhood of $600 million this year on housing. We support over 600 rental facilities across the state, but our largest program by far is our single family housing loan guarantee program. We're closing in on about 6,000 of those so far this year. We'll probably do close to 7,000 when this fiscal year is concluded.
So you guys play a role in the housing sector.
Yes, very big role.
Yeah,
I think our role is very important in maintaining our housing stock and maintaining home prices because we're such a big factor in the market. We also have a single family direct program where we're helping very low and very moderate income families get into what is probably their first home. That's very important to those families because we know that when a family moves into a home, there are other positive outcomes that occur. I read a study several years ago now that found when a family moves into their own home for the first time, they have a better diet, their kids get better grades in school, mm-hmm. and there's less domestic violence. Mm-hmm. There's that certainty of having a home that's so important and has many beneficial family outcomes.
And at what point is a project considered rural? At what point does it become your job to deal with these because it doesn't reach a certain threshold?
It depends on the project. We have numerous definitions of rural, but they fall into three basic categories. If it's a business program, which I haven't gotten into yet, our threshold is under 50,000. For our housing and community facilities programs, our threshold is under 20,000. And for our environmental programs, our water and waste projects, it's communities of 10,000 or less.
The grant program for public TV stations that I mentioned at the beginning is a national effort. WKAR-TV already broadcasts a digital signal, but many others don't. What are some of these other projects in Michigan, like the TV project, are you working on? Besides the housing, you've covered the housing pretty well.
Well, we've provided in the past grants and loans to Central Michigan Public Broadcasting and Northern Michigan Public Broadcasting for their digital conversion. This grant program, which was announced 2 weeks ago by Acting Undersecretary Doug O'Brien, is really a modest program. It's only $2.8 million nationally. And it's directed at those translators and other analog equipment that might still be in a digital broadcast center, mm-hmm. and provides assistance to finalize some of their digital conversion. Because we want rural communities to have the same access to quality television as urban areas do, and public television is a great source for education, entertainment, and news.
And public infrastructure is another area that you deal with in your agency. Talk about your role in things like water and sewer systems in small farming towns.
Yes. We will do somewhere in the neighborhood of $120 million a year in investments in rural communities. We provide financing for sewer systems. We provide financing for water systems. We also provide funding for other types of what I would call community infrastructure, and that's our community facilities program, where we can finance the construction of a new fire hall, a new town hall. We can finance the purchase of equipment for emergency responders, like police vehicles and fire trucks and ambulances, and right down to breathing apparatus for firemen. So everything a community uses, we can finance.
We're talking with James Turner, who is the Michigan director of the USDA Rural Development Agency, about its footprint here in the state of Michigan. Where do we see your agency's footprint in mid-Michigan?
Well, depending on how you define mid-Michigan, we've invested about $126 million in broadband. A lot of that, the largest project, half of that money, $64 million, went to a company called Air Advantage that is covering the thumb with broadband coverage. We also have projects in Climax down by Jackson. We have another one over in covering Macomb, Macostin, Owego, and Montcalm counties. And we have another one down in West Michigan, and another one up in the UP. So we're doing broadband all over the state. We have a lot of projects going on in the Gladwin Clear area. We work very strongly in Lake County. So that's just to name a few. I have not mentioned our business programs, and we have a very robust business and industry loan guarantee program.
Tell us about that.
Well, you know, we've gone through some tough credit times in the last few years.
Clearly.
And we have a business and industry loan guarantee program where we can provide a guarantee to a private lender for a small business in a rural community. The closest one to us right now are Elm Plating in Jackson, Michigan, a viable business, never behind on its payments, and its banks decided they didn't want to do business in Michigan, didn't want to do business in the auto industry anymore. So they found another lender that was willing to provide them with capital. We came in with a loan guarantee, and that business in Jackson has not only survived, but it's grown its labor force.
I don't think of Jackson as a rural community exactly.
It's under 50,000.
Oh, okay. So there is a threshold.
There's the business program threshold.
50,000 yes. Population. Now, I understand you've got some activity, though, here very close to WKAR in Shiawassee County in Owosso, a safe house domestic violence shelter.
Yes, we provided financing for that. We also provided financing to start the restoration of the community theater in Owosso. And that's, I think, a wonderful project. I like these downtown redevelopment entertainment venues. We're doing another one in Albion, where these are going to be destination places. And that's what we're trying to do with these rural communities, is help them make them destination places where people want to come and get some entertainment, spend some money in other places in the downtown area.
Does sequestration worry you? I mean, as far as your future activities go, I mean, the belt tightening continues to happen. Well, the economy has kind of perked up a little bit, but I mean, in the public sector, there's a noticeable shortage of funds to go around. Does that worry you, and will that impact your work?
Of course, it worries me. I want you to know, USDA kind of got ahead of the curve on sequestration. We've been working for 3 years now to become more efficient in what we do. We went through a couple of early retirement phases, and we've reduced the labor force. When I started this job, I had 126 people on board. Now I have 105.
Okay.
So we've had to adjust, but we're avoiding furloughs, and we're still delivering services.
James Turner is the Michigan director of the USDA Rural Development Agency, and we've been talking about the work that he does. Many thanks.
Thank you, Mark.
Everybody knows about Detroit's Motown music scene, but the story of Motor City rock and roll is less well known. Writer Steve Miller aims to change that with his book, Detroit Rock City. He'll talk about the book Wednesday night at the Schuller Bookstore in the Eastwood Town Center in Lansing. Current State Scott Pohl spoke with Steve Miller about the early days of hard rock in Detroit.
In the book, we start... We make mention of the Rationals, which is, you know, the mid-60s. And I wanted to take it through there only because it was probably the first salvo of guitar rock in Detroit. And that would become widely interpreted over the years, that guitar sound. So I wanted to do that. It started at what I considered the beginning and took it right up through today, really, the Stripes, the departure of the Stripes from Detroit, or Jack from Detroit, and so on. So I tried to be as comprehensive as I could.
Let's say the White Stripes and Jack White, for the benefit of people who aren't familiar with the White Stripes.
Of course,
the White Stripes and Jack White.
That's right, sure.
Isn't it amazing that Detroit spawned not only Motown, but so much great hard rock and roll at about the same time?
About the same time, that's right. And at the start of the book, it's explained in a way in several voices. It's an oral history, so there's no meddling. And I thought the people did a great job of explaining how, you know, that came about. There was, you know, your alternative to the factory, and that was rock. And that was, that's how it came about. The sounds of the factory are very evident, of course, in the rock and roll universe of Detroit. A good stamping plan will do wonders for your guitar sound.
You know, I don't want to dismiss you as a writer. I hope you don't take this way. But this, as you say, is an oral history.
Sure.
You ask the right questions, I assume, and assembled them in a logical fashion. But we're hearing from the artists and the hangers-on themselves in this book.
That's right. It makes me feel better that way. I mean, I'm really just sort of the guide. Or even the conduit of this information, and I thought, that's Detroit. Who better to tell the story? I mean, I wasn't there for everything, and so what I wanted to do is, I just wanted them to talk, and that's how I do all my interviews. Just about is hopefully you have a conversation rather than an interview. I suppose is how I look at it. And so when I was doing this, I was very conscious of the fact that I would not be editorializing or even placing into context anything. So in a way, it's a crash course for the unlearned.
How many of these acts were you able to see yourself in those days?
Well, in those days, due to my age, it was going to be kind of tough to catch a whole bunch of them. I remember seeing the MC5 do a sound check when I was 11 years old, and that was heavy enough for me. And then, you know, over the years, of course, I started going to shows in Detroit, early 70s. And from there on, I think it's safe to say I saw most of the bands that are in this book, starting about then.
I want to ask you about access to all of these performers and others in your book. Maybe ask you to comment on your favorite get, so to speak. And were there people involved in the Detroit rock scene that you weren't able to get access to?
It's interesting because when I made a comprehensive list when I started this out. It was a big, long list, and I just would add to it, and sometimes I'd subtract and so on. And I wasn't looking at people as gets, you know, so much as I was looking at who would be interesting and who could add something to the discussion. Of course, you wanted names because names draw readers. And so I was always happy, and I can't say there was a favorite get. I was always happy to talk to the bigger people, of course. Nugent, I'd interviewed him before, and I knew all you do is just, you know, let it go. And Iggy and the guys from the Five, I think, were just as heavy as always. I always think they're good interviews. I enjoyed sitting there listening. Jack White, a terrific. That was truly a conversation, and he was generous with his time. We spent a couple hours with him, and that was just an enjoyable experience. Anybody that I didn't get, I wish that I would have had something from Ron Ashton, guitar player from the Stooges. Ron, of course, is deceased. I was lucky enough to obtain an older interview, some footage, some sound recordings of an older interview, and that helped greatly. So I'm thankful that Ron Ashton has a voice in this book.
I find it interesting that you also talked with a number of people who were involved behind the scenes and people involved in the concert scene in those days, notably John Sinclair. So a lot of those people were instrumental in these stories that some of your readers may not be fully aware of.
Sure, yeah, and I thought that was really interesting. I always thought promoters had some of the best stories. There's the guy who used to book the Stooges, and he had to go out and follow them to make sure that they get to the gig, and those kinds of stories. I love that stuff. And I thought that was just as important as the stars to me in telling the story. Now, to a reader, perhaps they'd say, "Well, I want stars," but to me, those guys are stars too.
The subtitle of your book is "The Uncensored History of 5 Decades of Rock and Roll in America's Loudest City," and I want to ask you a little bit about the uncensored part, if only to point out to listeners who haven't seen your book that this isn't one that maybe you should leave laying around for the kids to pick up.
Probably not. I mean, these are grown-up tales about grown-up things. I suppose grown-up things. Grown-up as rock and roll is going to get, which usually has a rather stunted growth. I think it should stop at about 25. But yeah, it's definitely uncensored because it would be no fun to. And again, that to me alludes to the idea that it's a tell-all, like a history, and just people aren't inhibited from telling their stories at all.
Lots of sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
There is. There's a little of each. That's right. And that's exactly what it. That's what it takes to make something like this fly.
One aspect of the book that I found a little surprising, and perhaps I shouldn't have been surprised by it, is how much some of these people don't like each other or didn't like each other back in those days.
Well, that surprised me too, and there are some of that I actually left on the cutting room floor because I didn't want it to become I didn't want it to become a platform for diatribes against this person or that person or harboring old grudges. And I was surprised how old some of these grudges can be, but I guess these things die hard, and they took them pretty seriously back then, and they do now too, I suppose.
There's a new documentary that's beginning to make the rounds called Louder Than Love, and it focuses on the famous Grandy Ballroom in Detroit. Are you familiar with the film?
Yes, I'm familiar with the film. I've seen the trailer. I haven't seen the film itself yet.
Well, there was a preview screening of it recently, and it's my understanding that the curatorial director of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Howard Kramer, was there. And Howard Kramer is suggesting a crowdsourcing sort of a campaign to raise money to reopen the Grandy Ballroom. Now, it's been closed for over 40 years. A church owns it now. I don't know if you've heard about that campaign, but do you have any thoughts about the notion of reopening the Grandy Ballroom?
Yes, I've heard about it, and I found it rather disturbing. These kinds of places are time and place. You can't reproduce the magic of the Grandy Ballroom. I don't know what you would want to do opening it. I mean, a church sounds like a fine place for it to be, but those days are long past. And I think that it's better that you just let them exist in books and memories. And certainly the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has no place telling Detroit anything because thankfully the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is not in Detroit, but no, I don't think that there's any reason to even, to even ponder that. I don't know why. I don't know what you would do with it. I mean, are you going to bring back Led Zeppelin to play? Are you going to bring back is Cream going to play? The Five isn't going to play there. It doesn't make any sense to me. Yeah.
We should explain for people who aren't familiar with the Grandy Ballroom. If everybody who was anybody in rock and roll played the Grandy Ballroom, and especially the local acts, notably the MC5, their live album recorded there.
Yeah, that's right. Their first album was recorded live at the Grandy. They practiced there. They rehearsed there too. And there's stories in there about them rehearsing all alone in the Grandy with the lights out.
Yes, I'm starting to sweat, and now my shirt's all wet. get the feeling you got. Suck them all, put that mic in my hand and let me kick out the jam. Yes, kick out the jam. The kick out.
The Grandiose, I mean, really, it was one of those venues that, you know, it's like the Fillmore East, man. It's a historic, it's iconic, and it's no more. But it's a beautiful memory, and I think that's how it serves best at this point.
If I was to pin you down, Steve, and ask you to pick one Detroit act that deserved greater national or worldwide success than they got, what act might you choose?
The original Stooges, Iggy and the Stooges. Those first three albums are probably they define rock and roll, and they influenced entire movements. I mean, there would have been, without the Stooges, there's no Ramones. Without the Stooges, there's no British punk rock movement of the late of the 70s. And without that, then of course you have that whole cascading wave of other musical movements that came off that.
Am I right? You want something? You want something tonight? You want something? You want something? Alright. Oh, but I can't help because I'm not right. And it's always this way.
The Stooges' first three albums are probably, that's your whole rock and roll class right there. And you could take an entire semester and learn from those three albums.
The book is Detroit Rock City, the uncensored history of five decades of rock and roll in America's loudest city. Steve Miller is the author, compiler of these stories. Thank you so much, Steve. Nice to meet you.
All right. Thanks, Scott.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And a reminder that Steve Miller will talk about his book, Detroit Rock City, Wednesday at 7 p.m. at the Schuller Bookstore in the Eastwood Town Center here in Lansing. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we will review the month of July with WKAR-TV Off the Record host Tim Skubick and a few other Capitol Beat reporters. Also, a conversation with the great Garrison Keillor. All that and more tomorrow here on Current State on WKAR 90.5. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks to producer Emmanuel Berry, to Aaron Young for engineering, and to Andy Curtis for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. And by the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce, supporting more than 1,100 businesses in the greater Lansing area for more than 110 years. Information at lansingchamber.org.